Good afternoon. My name is Jack Park. I'm the chair of the Professional Responsibility and Legal Education Practice Group.
More volume.
And I'd just like to introduce the practice group briefly. One of the things we try to do is be of service to the members of the group, of the society. We offer a diversity CLE for those states that require diversity in their CLE. We offer an ethics update each year for society members. And that ethics update will probably be sometime in December. We also have a need for a student liaison. Our student liaison graduated. And if any of you can think of a student who's interested in these professional responsibility and legal education issues, we'd be delighted to hear of it. Our moderator, who I'll introduce and then I'll get out of your way, is Judge Carlos Bea. He's a senior judge on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals and a great friend of the Federalist Society. He has had a remarkable career and filled with private practice, teaching, and service to the community. And with that, I'll turn you loose, Judge.
Thank you very much, Mr. Park. I can tell that you're all lawyers because you still are like in law school, hardly anybody sits in the front row because you think you're going to be called on. But I'm not going to call on you right away anyway. Okay. Today, let's go over the panel, the question here is oversight what we're really talking about is the oversight of the ABA Council on Law Schools with respect to the curriculum which is required of law schools. Now, you wonder why we're discussing this, and a little bit of background. We're not picking on the ABA because of any perceived ideological or a legal or political leanings, but the ABA is important because it exercises control over some of the most important aspects of law schools, which is a law school curriculum. And the basis of its importance and its control is that the ABA is the only institution which can accredit law schools for the purposes of state bar examinations, and importantly, for student loans under the Department of Education. So if you don't go to a law school, and 200 of them, more than 200 of them in the country, if you don't go to a law school that is accredited by the ABA, you're not eligible to get a student loan, and you may not be able to stay there for very long. And if you do want to practice law, you have to be a graduate of an accredited law school. Only 4 states don't require it. Everybody else, every other state requires that accreditation in order to sit for the bar examination. So the question is whether the present, standard of the ABA Council on Legal Education is subject to any questioning on grounds of the recent cases that came out in 2023 in the Harvard and North Carolina cases and the affirmative action cases. We won't deal today with admission or hiring practices in the law schools. We'll deal only with the curriculum. And I want to draw your attention to the curriculum which is proposed by the ABA. And I'll read it slowly so that you get the full import of it, and then we'll go into some discussions. We have a distinguished panel here, which I'm honored to be able to introduce. But the particular standard is Standard 303, C, which reads, a law school shall, that's mandatory, right, shall provide education to law students on bias, cross-cultural competency, and racism. One, at the start of the program of legal education, and two, at least once before graduation. For students engaged in law clinics or field placements, the second educational occasion will take place before, concurrently with, or as part of their enrollment in clinical or field placement courses. So, well, how we're going to proceed is, first of all, I'll introduce the panelists, and the panelists will speak for 5 or 8 minutes on a subject which they've chosen, and then we'll have some questioning back and forth on the panel, and then we'll go to the public to ask for questions from you. So it's my great pleasure to start introducing, to my left, Ms. Jennifer Rosato Perea, who's the Managing Director and Accreditation of the Legal Education of the ABA. She's been newly appointed as the Managing Director of Legal Education and Accreditation at the American Bar Association. She was the first woman and first Latina to serve in this role to oversee the accreditation of close to 200 law schools. She served as a dean at 3 different law schools over 16 years. Those were at DePaul, at Northern Illinois University College, and at Drexel University. She's been awarded the Vanguard Award by the Chicago Bar Association, the Trailblazer Award from the Hispanic Lawyers Association of Illinois, and the Women's Bar Association of Illinois. Ms. Perea received her Bachelor of Science degree at Cornell University and her Juris Doctor at University of Pennsylvania. Next to speak is Dr. Dana Bowen Matthew, who is the Green Professor of Law and Dean of the George Washington University of Law School. Dean Matthew is the author of the best-selling book, Just Medicine, A Cure for Racial Inequality in American Health Care, and Just Health, Treating Structural Racism to Heal America. Dean Matthew, Dr. Matthew, served on the faculty of the University of Virginia Law School, and she served as the Robert Wood Johnson Health Policy Fellow for the U.S. Senator Debbie Stabenow, as Senior Advisor in the Office of Civil Rights of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and she currently serves as a non-resident senior scholar in the Center for Health Policy at the Brookings Institution and is a member of the American Law Institute. Next after her to speak is Dean Michael Barry. Dean Barry earned his JD from the Yale Law School, and then went on to clerk for U.S. District Court Judge Royce Lamberth and Chief Judge Bart Joflat of the U.S. Court of Appeals in the 11th Circuit. During his legal and business career, he practiced complex litigation in Phoenix, Arizona, and led the litigation group of Capital One in Richmond, Virginia. And last but not least, Justice Nels Peterson of the Supreme Court of Georgia. Judge Peterson was a judge on the Georgia Court of Appeal and general counsel for the University System of Georgia. He practiced at King and Spalding and clerked for Judge William Pryor, who is the chief judge now of the 11th Circuit, and he's a graduate of Kennesaw State University and Harvard Law School. So without further ado, Ms. Perea.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Can you hear me okay in the back? Yeah, wonderful. Notwithstanding the title of this panel, I'm very happy to be here representing the ABA. I'm the managing director, so I am not a decision maker, but I support the council, and I am liaison to many of the constituencies and stakeholders that the council has. And glad to be included in this discussion. One of the things that I'm trying to do in my first year is to listen and learn from many folks who have very different ideas about accreditation and its pain points and the issues of accreditation. So I'm glad to hear everyone, particularly in the Q&A period of this panel. So as Justin Bayeth said, we are the accreditor of JD programs. So we're not accreditors of universities, the council. We are the sole accreditor of JD programs. Non-JD programs can be accredited, for example, by a regional accreditor. So we really focus on the professional degree of the JD. We are recognized by the Department of Education, and again, with a new administration, we don't know what that will look like, but as for now, we are in a process of what we call re-recognition. We get recognized every 5 years, so the Department of Education will come in and look at the council's work, look under and in every kind of process that we have, and make sure that we are abiding by the Department of Education regulations. One thing to just note, to Judge Bea's point, most law students, loans can be recognized and approved through their regional accreditor. So there are only about 10 or so schools now that are the standalone schools for which that loan approval is crucial. But the most important thing in terms of the JD and accreditation is to create a basic level of quality. That's what the Department of Education talks about. What's the basic level of quality for a lawyer who is going into the practice of law? And Standard 301 gives us our North Star and our description that what we try to do through the accreditation process is to prepare our students upon graduation for admission to the bar and for effective, ethical, and responsible participation as members of the legal profession. And it's important to note that we are the accreditors, but not the regulators. As Judge Bea noted, it is the state Supreme Courts who are the regulators. So they have basically said, most of those states have said, if you are a graduate from an ABA-accredited law school and the standards have been adhered to, and you have passed a bar exam, unless you take an alternative pathway that's recognized by our court, we believe that you are a competent attorney and you are able to represent clients and we will and protect the public. And so that's been the model, although, as we're going to talk about, that model is being questioned both by the state Supreme Courts as well as by others. The council consists of 21 members, and it's important to note that the council is separate and independent from the larger American Bar Association. It's required, so when you see a resolution coming from the ABA House of Delegates, that's not the council. The only role of the House of Delegates after the council, for example, passes the standards, implements the standard, is for the in the process of approval, the House of Delegates has two times to either concur or reject whatever the council has come up with. And even if the House of Delegates rejects it twice, the council can do what is best for law schools and decide ultimately whether to promulgate the standard or not. And when standards are promulgated, they go through a notice and comment process. So there's a standards committee of the council that is the one that kind of vets different proposals that come in, look at what might be needed in terms of modification standards or additions to standards. So for example, the freedom of expression standard, which folks have talked about, standard 208, which just came through, came through with a lot of concern about what was going on at the law schools. And so the standards committee and then the council stepped in to make sure that we tried to have some standard for freedom of expression. Every standard goes through a notice and comment period in which everyone, including your organization, any members of the public can comment, and then the council then considers and determines whether to move forward. So as Judge Bea said, there are lots of standards that we could talk about. Most of the curricular requirements of the standards are those that are most basic that you understand from your own law school experience. Legal writing, experiential learning, pro bono opportunities, things like that. But there's not a dictating of particular subjects, although a lot of schools do a lot of the same things, right, to be competitive, but also to know what are the subjects that are tested on the bar and the subjects that will be most important for practicing attorneys. But what we're going to talk about today are two different standards, and I'm just going to spend, I know I only have a few minutes, is to focus on 303. There are two different standards that were passed, and the process went through its stages between 2020 and 2022. The first
standard is called, it was 303B3, and that's for professional identity formation. And that standard, which is in interpretation 3035, really came from a desire and a hope and an aspiration that students would more reflect on and actually incorporate the values of our profession while they were in law school. All we've had for many years since Watergate is the one course in ethics, and the thought was if we start to teach students values from the beginning and help them to take care of themselves and to be accountable and to think about what ethical responsibilities are, it will be better for them before they graduate, and better for all of us, and better for the public once they graduate. So 303B3 is professional identity formation. And again, there's a minimal requirement. It says substantial opportunities, but it's really up to the law school. The idea is you get introduced to those values early on in law school, and then you apply them as you go through, after your summer job, in your clinical experience, or your field placement, things like that. And so, again, left to the law schools, and the law schools have been developing that standard in the last year or so. 303C is, I think, what we want to focus on today, perhaps a little bit more controversial for some. As Judge Bea said, it is a requirement for instruction or education on bias, cross-cultural competency, and racism. And that particular provision came through the standards process. It was introduced, I think, by law deans, but was vetted through the process. And the idea was that having some knowledge and some tools in the toolbox about cultural competency, knowing and understanding others, to have some understanding of bias and racism in our structure in the legal system is important for lawyers in the world as they relate to different kinds of clients, different judges, and gives us a way to navigate in this world in those softer and harder skills. And so the promulgation of the standard, again, is very broad and open. It says here are the subject areas that we'd like you law schools to make sure that you have integrated into your curriculum, and it should be at least twice, right? So at the beginning and then one other time before graduation. And just so you know, that there are lots of different ways to meet that standard, and interpretation 3037 talks about some, and I think the deans may talk about some of the things that they've been doing in their law schools. It can be in an orientation session. It can be in a 1L class. It can be a module in a course. It can be a selection from a variety of courses. So again, the council does not order what will be done, but just says, you law schools, it's consistent with your mission, consistent with your community, you decide how you will develop that standard in your law school. And I think it's also important to know that the council in reviewing the law school, so law schools get reviewed every 10 years to be reaccredited, essentially. And they go through a site review process, and in reviewing this particular standard, the council and the site team and others that are reviewing the law school are very open and very flexible. Again, are you doing this? However you're doing it, just make sure that you are doing something and that we can at least account for what you're doing in the law school. So there have been no schools found out of compliance. This is not looking for a particular dogma or particular message, just to make sure that students are exposed to that range of perspectives related to this. And then I also want to add, and I just want to take a minute, is that there's also respect for the mission in promulgating the standard, the mission of the law school. And also the legislatures that have, for example, determined that some sorts of discussions are not legal, are not appropriate. So we are not asking law schools to do something that would put them in harm's way before the legislature, but they can do what they can within the standard and the construct of the law. So that's, I think, to lay it out there from the standards perspective, and I look forward to questions.
Dean Matthews.
So by way of full disclosure, I don't think my mic is working, but I have a very loud voice, as my students have told me. I am one of those law schools, thank you, that will be up for reaccreditation next year. So if you hear a large sucking sound in the room, you'll know exactly why. I have only wonderful things to say about the accreditation process, right? So let me take you back historically. We live in a world very different, my prepared remarks, a very different society from before the ABA accreditation project began. According to Susan Katcher, senior lecturer at the University of Wisconsin, during the colonial period before 1776, the colonies were founded on lawyers reflecting religious principles. So it was said that the legal profession, with its special privileges and principles, and its esoteric language, are aimed at building a legal profession that was both efficient and godly. We should be so lucky, right? This was because lawyers were not welcome. A Pennsylvania document referred to the colonies as a happy country for this reason. Why? Because people apparently were happy to do without lawyers, as they were an unfavored group and reflected an open quote, ancient English prejudice against lawyers who were distrusted, close quotes. In fact, the people of the American colonies would have been happy, said one historian, to do without lawyers for quite a while. They did just that. The distrust of lawyers became an institution. This is according to historian Daniel Bornstein. Another legal historian, Lawrence Friedman, said, open quotes, lawyers were, in the end, a necessary evil. This was the view for most of the 18th century. Now, how were these people, these distrusted people, trained? Many colonial lawyers went to the Inns of Court in the English system for essentially an apprenticeship. And they were inns much more heavily invested in eating and drinking and socializing than in training. But nonetheless, that English system eventually translated into an apprenticeship system that prevailed throughout the colonial period in the United States. Again, according to the same author, Satcher, these were the system of a high degree of training, but also a high degree of variability. The quality of your instruction depended on the quality of lawyer who was leading your apprenticeship. So during the colonial period, this is a quote, an apprenticeship or clerkship was essential for being admitted to the bar. Those wanting to become lawyers in the colonial period sought an established lawyer, paid a fee, got practical experience working in the lawyer's office, as well as more academic learning by receiving instruction. At best, the quality was you got to read a few law books. At worst, the apprentice toiled away at drudgery and copywork. There were no law schools in colonial America. There was no ABA. Each colony set its own standard for entering the bar, and many lawyers practiced only part-time in combination with other occupations. Now, gradually, our profession grew in professionalism, and law practice became essential to the new United States. We became essential as, open quote, technicians of change as the country expanded economically and geographically. And boy, did public attention and opinion change. After the Revolution, the number of lawyers surged in the United States. And on visiting the United States in the 1830s, Alexis de Tocqueville referred to the bar and the judicial bench as the American aristocracy. What a difference a day makes, or a war, maybe. How did this happen? Well, through apprenticeships still in the United States. Again, variable in nature. Another quote. Lawrence Friedman, a legal historian, said that legal instruction in the early days of the Republic continued to be provided by an apprenticeship, which tended to be uninspiring. So where did law schools come from? We evolved from this apprenticeship-based system of college lecturers. The first one was actually a small college called Litchfield School in Connecticut. By show of hands? Litchfield School in Connecticut lasted for about 50 years, educating about 1,000 students before it closed in 1833. But by 1850, there were 50 law schools that were private, like mine, but they did not give degrees. Instead, many lawyers read law, and again, the variability persisted. Think Andrew Jackson, a Carolinian who read law for 2 years during his teens and became a lawyer, and Abraham Lincoln, and we know his story. Now, law schools became a part of universities as a part of a movement called the Jacksonian Democracy. I never heard of it until I was researching this. Jacksonian Democracy? Yes. Okay, well, you'll correct me if I'm wrong on this.
This lasted between the 1830s and about 1860. It was under the influence of President Jackson and resulted from an increase in a new generation of voters who spoke the talk of equality, but of course did not walk the walk, as the movement of equality was limited demographically, by gender, by race, by land ownership, but these men called lawyers were the aristocracy of that day. It was a popular movement, but that movement had a disdain for elitism. In the viewpoint of historian Samuel Eliot Morrison, the movement had contempt for intellect. It catered to mediocrity. It diluted politics with incompetence. You get the drift. He did not think highly of Jacksonian democracy. It also was influential at the time on the education of lawyers. So it was thought towards the middle of the 19th century, when there were about 10 universities that had now offered not just college reading courses in law, but also colleges of law themselves, that these affiliated law schools needed some standards. In 1865, the oldest law school in the District of Columbia was founded. Right after the Civil War was over and the Union Army marched triumphantly down Pennsylvania Avenue, my law school was opened 3 months later. This was because lawyers then and lawyers now are needed to solve some of the most pressing challenges of our democracy. I'm very proud of my law school. I'll continue. Friedman said that law schools then became prestigious. He linked it to the rise in social change, and he linked it to the rise of integrating both the aristocracy and the middle class into the legal profession. Of course, this profession at that time excluded over 700,000 descendants of African descent, over 1 million women, and an untold number of Native Americans. By the end of the 19th century, the Journal of Legal Education tells us that the rise of the ABA became an important part of the legal education experiment. The American Bar Association was founded in 1878, and this year was immediate, and after it was founded, was immediately followed by this representation publicly. Open quotes, "There is little, if any, dispute now as to the relative merit of education by means of law schools. Without disparagement of mere practical advantages, the verdict of the best informed is in favor of law schools." I vote aye. With this preference, the ABA then in 1893 established the section on legal education, and here's my point. They adopted, by 1921, four essential goals. Number one, the American Bar Association is of the opinion that every candidate for the admission to the bar should get evidence of graduation from a law school complying with standards. Two, it shall require as a condition of admission at least 2 years of study in a college. Three, it shall require its students to pursue a course of 3 years of duration if they devote substantially all of their working time to the studies, or longer of that equivalent if they are working part-time. And four, it shall provide an adequate library. So you see, I conclude that these goals remain important, even though I am shuddering in my boots as to how they will be applied to me next year. I say when we juxtapose these goals of the American Bar Association with the history of law schools and lawyers and the reputation, what we have is a way to ensure inclusive excellence. One, to build trust in those who depend on the access to justice by lawyers, and two, to standardize the quality of their education that produces the members of the bar who are the keepers of liberty, the keepers of justice, the keepers of freedom, and the keepers of our rights and democracy. Albeit a flawed organization and accreditation process. After all human organizations are flawed. I dare say my church, my government, and even my law school is flawed. But yet, the trust, quality, and inclusive excellence that these standards achieve seem as important to me today as they did in 1878. Now, with respect to 303, C, and B, I was asked yesterday when I was at Duke receiving, this is a humble brag, receiving an award because I was presumed to know something about justice.
what good is justice after all? Very highfalutin question, right? I said there are lots of kinds of justice. There's utilitarian justice, we're trying to make everybody happy. There's libertarian justice, we're trying to leave everybody alone. There's Rawlsian justice, we're trying to make sure that equality and fairness rule the day. The point is that here's what law schools are really, really good at, that nobody else can do, and that we should keep them doing well and up to standards that may have to be examined and interrogated from time to time, like we are doing today. We should keep law schools thinking about what is good and just and right about our nation and making sure that we produce people dedicated to that noble profession of protecting exactly that. So I would say that the oversight is essential. I would say that indeed it does at time require interrogation as to whether it's been overreaching. But most importantly, it should reflect the collective moral convictions of our nation, of our nation's lawyers, through our nation's law school. And I thank the ABA so much for how well you do that.
Thank you very much. Now, Dean Barry.
Good afternoon. I'm pleased to have the opportunity to participate in this year's NLC, and I'm also so impressed to see so many people wanting to relive law school today. I'm hoping you did the reading assignment. My name is Mike Barry, and from 2019 through this past summer, I was the president and dean of South Texas College of Law, Houston. That is one of those private and independent law schools that Jen just mentioned is one of the 10 that requires the certification by the ABA to receive federal student loans. I'm also happy to say that I am the dean, and one of the things that I accomplished was acquiring and creating the Centennial Chair in Constitutional Law to recognize and to support our own Professor Josh Blackman over here in the second row. Our school, coincidentally, also is being reaccredited next year. So a very important and necessary caveat, I am the former dean, and my remarks are my own and not the College of Law, which I again say is up for reaccreditation this year. Judge Bea has given us the provocative question of the ABA, oversight or micromanagement? And as we are all good lawyers, of course, the answer to this either-or question is yes. Both are true. So let's take the micromanagement part first. As Jen noted, to ensure that South Texas remains an ABA-approved law school next year, I knew we had to comply with these. These are the ABA standards, and I kept this copy next to my desk at all times at the law school. Right out of the gate, Section 101 dictates that a law school seeking approval by the council shall demonstrate, you're going to hear the word shall a lot, shall demonstrate that it is being operated in compliance with these standards. And as you've heard, every 10 years, we have to do a self-study, several hundred pages demonstrating that we are in compliance with these standards. Now, for context, you've heard there are 200 ABA-accredited law schools, more or less. And it's important to understand that every single one of those law schools is different. It has a different mission, a different approach to legal education, a different student body, a different culture. In my experience alone, just comparing and contrasting the little law school that I attended up in New Haven, home to some of the Federalist Society's founders, to the two law schools where I have worked, St. Mary's in South Texas, very different schools. And in our little city of Houston, okay, very big city of Houston, we have three law schools, the University of Houston, Thurgood Marshall School of Law, and ours. You could not think of three more different law schools. But these ABA standards are a one-size-fits-all rule. The same rules apply to all 200 different schools. And they govern the day-to-day operations in a similar fashion, the process of legal education. So what does this mean in practice? That means that every law school, for instance, has to offer 2 hours of professional responsibility, 2 faculty-supervised writing courses, 6 hours of experiential education. That's Standard 303A. Standard 304 has 2 pages detailing what an experiential education course must look like. Standard 311A mandates that law school must be 83 or more hours long. You cannot go shorter. You cannot come up with a different approach. 403A discusses what faculty members can teach what courses. 509 talks about the disclosures that must be on every website. The 600s and 700s guide the law school library, the facilities. The word that keeps showing up throughout them is shall. These are not optional. Now, it's not that any of these standards necessarily is wrong, and as Dean Matthews says, they should be interrogated. In fact, many of them are very valuable. But the standards are prescriptive, and thus they limit the ability of law schools to experiment, to innovate, to change. I spent 15 years in Fortune 100 and 200 companies. I'm used to assessing outputs. Did we hit our sales targets? Did we hit budget? Did we deliver on time? Did we deliver the quality that we promised? A different approach for the ABA would be consider outputs more than the process by which those outputs are created. And among many possible metrics, two jump to mind. First, everyone in this room knows or soon will know if they are a student that there's a painful experience at the end of the law school journey. It's called the bar exam. Unlike most undergraduate and other graduate programs, the legal profession uses the bar exam to determine minimum competency for practice. With very few exceptions, graduating law schools take the bar exam. And there are many reasons to question whether the bar exam is an appropriate method of assessment, but still it exists for many students. Indeed, one of the great advantages of attending an ABA-accredited law school, as Jen identified, is that you are able to sit for the bar in any American jurisdiction. Thus, the bar exam and how well a school's graduates do is one measure to determine whether a law school is actually meeting its obligations. In addition, the National Association for Legal Placement and the ABA track whether law school's graduates get jobs as attorneys or in the legal profession. Again, an easy, objective way to determine whether the marketplace is accepting the graduates of a law school for the role that they have designed to do. Thus, these measures exist, and the question could be asked, and perhaps should be asked, whether an entire book of prescriptions on the methods should be as valuable as measuring the outputs. But I said the answer to the either-or question is yes. So let's turn to the oversight portion. In some ways, it is important to remember the thankless and very difficult task that Jen has. First, as an accreditor approved by the Department of Education, she and the council must adapt to and abide by and change with the Department of Education's ever-evolving guidelines. Second, Jen has a cadre of deans, two on the dais right now, and faculty members who are constantly baying for new opportunities and for exceptions to and more flexibility from the standards. And third, Jen and the section on legal education are within the ambit of the ABA. They're separate from, but they are within the scope of the ABA. And I probably don't need to detail to the members of this audience that the ABA can have perspectives on particular issues. And the standards do provide flexibility. In fact, any law school can seek a variance from the standards for a particular program. There's a process, and they're not always granted, but there is a mechanism by which that can be done. And perhaps most importantly, Standard 201A states, and this is a quote, "The dean and the faculty shall have the primary responsibility and authority for planning, implementing, and administering the program of legal education." What does that mean in English? It's a very significant grant of authority to the faculty to determine what goes on in the classroom. I've got a degree in theology. In Catholic theology, we would call this the principle of subsidiarity. You let the decisions be made as close to the, where they are going to be put into effect. So in other words, most of what happens in the most important rooms, the classrooms, are not determined by the ABA. They're determined by the faculty. So, both and. So very quickly turning to 303. How does this happen at various law schools? 200 different ways. Every law school will apply it in its own image. I'll speak briefly about South Texas. First of all, it is crucial that we do not have any form of indoctrination, any form of dogma that must be accepted. There is not, that is contrary to law school, that is contrary to legal education, that is contrary to the principles of inquiry that are mandatory in an educational institution. Second, for South Texas, much of this is second nature. Houston is the most diverse city in the country, according to the Census Bureau. Our population of students is largely first generation, significantly minority. This is part of who we are, a cross-cultural environment. Third, we're a practice-ready school. And it is important for our students to be able to understand that the person across the table from them may have a different perspective on the world. They will be a better advocate if they can appreciate and understand that others view the world differently. Fourth, we do not use race in our admissions decisions. We did not before SFA, and we don't now. And then finally, our faculty members have a diverse and varied and thoughtful perspective on issues, whether they relate to viewpoint, religion, economic background, geography, et cetera. That is crucially important for our students, that they are exposed to a variety of experiences in their education. So, is the ABA a micromanager? Personally, not speaking for the school who's being accredited next year, one could say that. But does it constrain our school negatively and prevent us from being the school that we need to be? No, it does not. I look forward to the discussion. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dean. Now, Justice Peterson, would you weigh in?
Thank you, Judge. It works. So you've heard three really interesting approaches to ABA accreditation covering a broad range of subjects. And I am going to add a fourth. And I'm actually going to step back a little bit and look at the issue from a broader level of generality and focus principally on accreditation writ large. Not just law school accreditation, but higher education generally and K-12 for that matter. And in particular, the government's reliance on private non-governmental accreditation agencies that the government permits to serve as gatekeepers for access to public benefits and government licensing. And when I say the government, my principal focus is the federal government, because the federal government is the one that principally does that. But there's also, for one finger pointing at them, there's three fingers pointing back at me, because state Supreme Courts are a critical part of the reliance on the ABA accreditation. And so we're here. I see several of my friends and colleagues from Texas and Alabama and Tennessee here. I promise any criticism I do of us is really just of me and not of you. But so an important background element of this conversation is the fact that the ABA is a private organization. And as a private organization, it lacks key forms of public accountability that generally apply to the government. And the federal government delegates to the ABA the authority to accredit law schools. Federal law conditions the availability of many federal student aid programs on institutions being accredited. And federal law prohibits, generally speaking, the Department of Education from exercising discretion, supervision, or control over accreditation agencies. And so simultaneously, you have and I know we can quibble over whether it's really a grant of authority, but it's certainly a reliance on decisions made by, which in my view is indistinguishable from a grant of authority, combined with the self-conscious refusal by the federal government to provide substantive guidelines. Certainly there's some regulation, but federal law prohibits the regulation of substantive guidelines. And that combination of private unaccountability and delegation of public authority is what I want to focus on. Now, that said, I think accreditation can be valuable. I'm a believer in the free market. Accreditation arose initially, as we heard from Dean Matthew, really as a market signal of quality in education. And before you go and drop hundreds of thousands of dollars on higher education, it is not a bad idea to have experts assess the quality and value of the degree you're about to purchase. And when we talk about federal financial aid, it is not a bad idea that before the government hands out billions of dollars in taxpayer dollars, that they ensure that the institutions those are being spent at are real schools. And in fact, the advent of the GI Bill and substantial access to federal funds for education was really the key time when the federal government started requiring accreditation to ensure that those funds did not get misused. So this is not a statement that accreditation itself is unvaluable or unuseful. It's more a function around the responsibility of government to ensure certain things. And when we talk about market signals do not require the federal government's imprimatur, and controls on government expenditures generally ought to be done by the government. And I know it is rare for someone to come to the Federalist Society and say that perhaps the government should be doing more. And I say that with some hesitation. And let me just say, it is a real honor to be here. The first one of these I attended was as a 2L in 2002. And I met my wife working the FedSoc table at Admitted Students Weekend my 3L year at Harvard. So I have a lot of affection for this organization. But coming back to the substance at hand, in my view, there are serious consequences of essentially delegating key governmental decision-making to private organizations. Those private organizations are not bound by the Constitution's protections for individual liberty and are not subject to the Constitution's structural limitations on the government exercise of power. And these consequences are even greater when the educational institution being accredited is a public institution. Over the years, we have seen, and I have personally witnessed, a variety of examples of state and local governments seeking to regulate their own educational institutions and being stymied by private accreditors. This materially undermines popular sovereignty and fundamental principles of federalism. And again, this is not to single out the ABA. This is generally true of all private accreditors authorized by government to accredit educational institutions from K-12 to higher ed. So let's talk about non-delegation for a second. Everyone's favorite constitutional doctrine that may or may not exist. And to be clear, as a judge, I'm bound by certain rules in the Code of Judicial Conduct, and so I express no opinion as to whether the federal government's use of private accreditors is actually unconstitutional under existing federal non-delegation doctrine to the extent that it exists. I also, and I say this as a caveat, but also as kind of maybe something that people ought to think about, I express no opinion as to the constitutionality under state constitutional non-delegation doctrine of state Supreme Court's reliance on ABA accreditation of law schools as a condition for sitting for the bar exam. Instead, this is a point about the first principles that underlie the idea of non-delegation. Non-delegation really is inherent in any system of government that has separation of powers. If powers are to be separated, then one branch can't exercise the power of another branch. But the kind of non-delegation we're talking about here is an even more fundamental form of non-delegation. When the people of a particular sovereign vest constitutional authority in their government, that government is not permitted to then go and give that authority they've been entrusted to a private entity and to wield in a way that is not accountable to the public. And that core form of non-delegation doctrine is, I think, something that everyone in the system ought to be thinking more clearly about. Constitutional protection of individual liberty as well. And again, credit where credit is due, the ABA's new section 208 requiring accredited law schools, even private ones, to comply with First Amendment free expression principles is a really good thing. And frankly, may cause some law schools to take more seriously the responsibility to protect free expression than the existence of the Constitution itself does. But that's really the only thing that governs the ABA in terms of individual liberty protections. Private accreditation agencies have consistently been held by courts to be not to be state actors. And as a non-state actor, they are not subject to federal due process. They are not subject to, you know, the First Amendment themselves. They are not subject to any of the other individual rights that the Constitution secures. I will say, and one thing that I discovered in my preparation for this, a number of circuits have actually created a federal common law right of due process that the law schools can assert against the ABA, which I found fascinating. You know, you learn in law school that there is no federal common law, and then as soon as you get out of law school, you learn that the broad doctrines you learn in law school all have caveats, which I think goes to show how critical ABA accreditation is for law schools, because the rationale those circuits have applied is federal common law due process is something that applies when the government is relying on somebody that due process doesn't apply to decide really critical things that affect vested rights. But even a federal common law right to due process is not a substitute for robust protection of fundamental constitutional rights. And I'll say this goes beyond free expression. I spent time as general counsel for the University System of Georgia. I also spent time as the general counsel to the governor of Georgia. And in both of those roles, I dealt with a number of accreditation issues where students, who of course are not the beneficiary of the federal common law right of due process, where students were raising free exercise concerns, both students in med school and students in psychology counseling school. And the school's response typically was, well, we have to do these things for accreditation purposes. Another thing that's absent is, again, the Constitution's structural limitations on government exercise of power. As much as we all love the Bill of Rights, far more fundamental a protection of individual liberty is the structural limitations that the Constitution contains. And private accreditation agencies have no separation of powers. They are not subject to the voters throwing them out if voters don't like particular accreditation decisions. Also, state and local government interests, state and local governments have interests in regulating their own educational institutions. And voters have an interest in their government that is responsive to them, at least in theory, being able to make key decisions about education. A brief example of how this occasionally becomes a problem. My first week on the job in the governor's office in July of 2008, I got handed the file with SACS, now Advanced Ed, it's a key accreditor for K-12 schools. And they were going through the process of removing the accreditation of the Clayton County school system in South Atlanta, which was the first time a school system in the United States had their accreditation revoked in 40 years. The reason they did this was not a failure to teach the students. It was not, corruption or anything like that. It was because they had recently adopted a new standard requiring school board governance to be at a certain level. In Georgia, the people have decided that we want to elect our own school board members. Sometimes, and I know this will come as a complete shock to everyone in the room, when you elect government officials, they don't always get along with each other. Sometimes they like to make their own decisions and they like to micromanage. And this school board was, unsurprisingly, did not get along with each other, and they started micromanaging. Now, good boards get along with each other and don't micromanage. It is good for a board to do that. But when the people get to choose their board, and their state constitution says that they get to choose them, it is odd to have an unelected private accreditation agency to come in and say, well, because of that, we are going to take your accreditation. So, what should we do with these concerns? And again, as a judge, I'm usually limited in my ability to express too much of an opinion, and so all of this is at a high level of generality, and none of it is an expression of any view on any legal issue. But short of the federal government changing course, the ability of states to develop alternative approaches to accreditation is very limited. And I know that will seem, as a state Supreme Court justice, as something of a cop-out, and it may be. But here's the thing. In Georgia, we obviously allow the graduate of any ABA-accredited law school to sit for the bar. We also allow any Georgia law school, even if not accredited, to sit for the bar, because we're familiar with our local law schools. We used to have a couple of unaccredited law schools. One went out of business, one became accredited, and so now all of the Georgia law schools are ABA accredited. But we also have students from law schools all over the country coming to sit for the Georgia bar exam. Our ability to reach into those schools in other states is really very limited. And to, on our own, determine the quality of the education that's being done there. And so you really do need, when we talk about something like law school accreditation, you really do need a national approach, whether that needs to be the government or otherwise. But I do think the federal government should change course. I think it should seriously reconsider its reliance on private accreditation agencies, or at the very least broaden the ability of states or groups of states to create their own, particularly K-12 and the like. And state Supreme Courts should really think more seriously about whether we have made ABA accreditation too much of a gatekeeper in managing access to the bar exam. And other state and local government entities that rely on private accreditors should do the same. And then finally, because I have avoided mentioning Section 303 altogether, and this only barely touches on it, accreditation agencies, recognizing the lack of public accountability, should carefully avoid establishing standards that are politically charged or otherwise unduly intrude on government functions. The last thing I will do is simply observe a pending lawsuit that exists that I also discovered during my preparation for this, filed by the state of Florida this year. It was dismissed in October by a district court, Florida versus Cardona. And it is a constitutional challenge to the federal government's requirement of accreditation for access to student aid. And the state of Florida, represented by Henry Whitaker, the Solicitor General, brought a non-delegation doctrine challenge, a spending clause challenge, and an appointments clause challenge. And that case is presently on appeal to the 11th Circuit. So something to follow. And with that, I will open it up to questions.
Thank you very much. Well, I've been taking very seriously some of the presentations about a judge's duty to read the statute and interpret the statute. And when I take a look at the 303C that we're discussing here regarding courses that have to be given in order to assure accreditation, I find some terms that I don't quite fully understand as to their content. And the first of that, of those terms, is the term cross-cultural competency. And I ask the two deans, what kind of courses do you teach in cross-cultural competency, and what is their subject matter?
So we don't teach a course in cross-cultural competency. We ask people to talk about different cultures and be able to do so competently.
So you have professors to talk about different cultures?
So what we really do, and we've tried a couple of things, is we have conversations. We ask people, because we are really careful about admitting students from a wide variety of backgrounds, perspectives, cultures, we ask students to share on some of the things that their cultures inform them about in a hypothetical, and we talk across differences. It's one of the ways that we equip lawyers to behave responsibly in a pluralist society. We make sure that we have many cultures represented, and we ask people, as part of our, I think, commitment to that history I talked about, solving some of the most divisive issues in the history of our country, we make sure people can listen to one another. We make sure that people can express themselves in civil ways. We make sure that people can have an experience where they are taught and get to practice the art of disagreeing agreeably.
Okay, and how do you give examinations on cross-cultural competency if you give them?
We don't.
How about bias and racism? Who are your guiding lights as far as authors or theories about bias and racism?
The literature is copious about bias, how to measure it, where it shows up, what it does, how it influences. There's debates about whether you can or cannot measure it. It's a literature I know pretty well because I write about it. It's over 50 years old. And we've tried different authors at different times, I being one of them.
And examinations, do you give examinations in bias and racism?
No. What we do is talk about how every human being comes to a problem with preconceived notions. And we try to reveal how important those are to account for. It's something I learned when I was practicing as a litigator and realized that there were ways in which I was preparing for cases with people that I didn't know and hadn't encountered before that were influenced negatively by the fact that I just was unfamiliar with their culture and their background. So I thought it was a really important addition for me to be able to expose students to by experience, not exam.
Same in that certainly not graded, not assessed. Particularly in clinical programs, in advocacy programs, having folks who practice before juries come and talk to students about how you approach a jury can actually be very helpful for them to realize that just because the budding attorney approaches a problem in a particular way, the people sitting in the box may have a different perspective. And if you don't appreciate that and account for that, you're going to not be serving your client well. So in many ways, it's just making them aware of the reality that people approach the world.
Okay. My next question is going to be to Ms. Perea. Can you give us any examples of the kind of courses which cover cross-cultural competency bias and racism?
Well, I think as the dean said, there are so many ways that the law schools can cover this. And it can be, as they talked about, in orientation, in career services, can have a professionalism course or in professional responsibility. You can have modules in that. So it's not so much that there is a course devoted to it, is that aspects of these kind of discussions and understandings and awarenesses can happen at different points in the curriculum. Now, for some schools, they do have some courses that they might mark as ones that would count for that requirement. I think as Dean Barry mentioned, I mean, clinical education by definition usually includes some of this when you take the seminar for the clinic or for the field placement. But there are also other kinds of, you know, if you take civil rights law, disability law, racism in the law, anti-Semitism in the law. There are many kinds of courses if the school decides that's how they want to meet it. Otherwise, it's more kind of weaving in and integrating these focused discussions at different points in the curriculum. Is that a fair?
That's
fair. And as I think they said, it can be co-curricular
or it can be in the curriculum. So as you say, we don't have to have a test. We could have a discussion in orientation, or we could have a discussion as part of the 1L year that is apart from a graded assignment.
How about any law schools? Has any law schools been found in violation of 303C by not teaching courses or having discussions in cross-cultural competency bias and racism?
None at all.
Okay. Justice Peterson, there are some countries that don't have bar examinations, and there are some states that allow graduates of their own schools to practice law in those jurisdictions. Are you in favor of elimination of bar examinations?
So I am going to take a very unpopular view and say that I actually believe the bar exam serves a useful function and should not be discarded. For the first 6 years of my time on the court, I was our court's bar admissions and bar regulatory person. And we had to do a lot of adjustment during COVID, pivot to a virtual, online exam. At the end of the day, I know a lot of folks may have different views on, the bar exam doesn't test the right things, the substance, doesn't tell you much. In my view, the key thing that the bar exam does is it assesses whether the law student who is seeking to represent people, seeking to have their lives in their hands, whether they are capable of processing an enormous amount of information in a short period of time and then be able to apply that to specific questions or circumstances. Regardless of whether or not you remember anything about the rule against perpetuities, assessing whether you can process a lot of information in a short period of time and apply it to particular problems tells you a lot about whether that person is going to be competent as a lawyer. And at the end of the day, the purpose for state Supreme Courts regulating the practice of law is to protect the public and to ensure that the people that we vest with the authority to practice law have some grounding in a capacity to represent the public in a way that is good for them.
Ms. Perea, do you have?
Yeah, I think that Judge Peterson raises a great point about what some of the other pressures are on law schools besides accreditation. So just the idea of having a high stakes exam has now moved law schools in order, and our requirement is 75%, which is actually not, it's not really high, and most of the schools make it, but it does create a lot of pressure for law students to take bar tested and courses, plus also the bar preparedness and all of that. So if we, again, in a different world, if we didn't have a high stakes bar exam, it might be different, different pressures. The same, I think, the other pressure we see in law schools right now, and we're getting, as we have discussions with the CLEAR Commission, for example, the state Supreme Court justices, because they're struggling with all of this and how important accreditation is or is not, is the bridge to practice, is that we're both seeing the same issue, which is students aren't as well prepared for the practice of law. But whose responsibility is it? Is it the accreditor's responsibility? Is the law school's responsibility? Is it the state Supreme Court's responsibility? And I guess the last thing I'd say is to Justice Peterson's point before about, other accreditors and standards. I think there is a value to that national approach, whether it's our approach or a different approach. It takes a lot of time to do these reviews, to enforce standards. And I think it's crazy making for law students these days who want portable bar exams to be able to say, okay, what does state A want, what does state B want, what does state C want? So one of the things that we're trying to think about is the value, kind of thinking about critically, what's the value of uniformity? Do we get the quality that we need? And what are the differences that we really need to account for that are really going to not put so much pressure on the law schools and students who have a tremendous amount of debt to add to that burden and debt by having different accreditors and different standards? So just a larger picture I just wanted to tease out from your great comments.
Let me ask a question of you, Ms. Perea. Has there been any litigation by any law school to seek to declare the standard 303C as being violative of their rights?
No, there's not been any challenges. In fact, when this was out for the during the standards process, there really was very little resistance, so to speak. It went through fairly smoothly at the time, and I think part of it is, first of all, it's been in effect for about a year, a little bit over a year. No schools have been cited, so there would not be a violation, so to speak, from which they could litigate. Usually, if there's going to be some harm, then that's where we would see a notice to litigate. But we haven't had complaints from schools because I think most of the schools see the value of it and then are integrating it in their own ways. And so it doesn't seem to be, at least for now, a problem from the law school perspective.
A lot of our panels are talking about the Students for Fair Admissions versus Harvard and North Carolina. Has that impacted these programs in any way?
No, it has not. Where we have been looking very carefully is on our standard 206, which relates directly to admissions and directly governed by SFA. But SFFA doesn't, in my view, and others could disagree, affect what you talk about in the classroom related to race and ethnicity. And in fact, Justice Roberts, at the end of the opinion, actually opened the door to conversations and understanding about race and ethnicity because he kind of encouraged the law school to look at applications, for example, on how race and ethnicity affected the lives of prospective students and what they could add to the law school community. So it seemed to me that it would at least allow for that discussion in the classroom, since none of it's being prohibited or barred from any student.
I'd like to open the panel to ask questions among each other, if there any there are, and if not, we'll open it up to the public. All right, public, please state your name and where you come from and your association.
Ben Flowers, Columbus, Ohio chapter. I'm the president of the Columbus chapter. So I pulled up Rule 206. 206A requires, it says, law school shall demonstrate a commitment to having a student body that is diverse with respect to gender, race, and ethnicity. 206B says a law school shall demonstrate with concrete action a commitment to diversity and inclusion by having a faculty and staff that is diverse with respect to gender, race, and ethnicity. So my question is, explain to me how it's possible to comply with either of those without violating some combination of the 14th Amendment, Title VI, Title VII, 1981, and so on.
In two sentences. Well, first, I think my short answer to that is that's why 206 is under review. A new version of it is out for notice and comment, which you can take a look at. To the extent that 206 focuses on inputs, not outcomes, efforts, concrete efforts, but not measured in outcomes, that I believe is still permissible under SFFA, but the new revisions will hopefully address some of your concerns. So that's out for notice and comment. You can look for it on the website. That tries to address some of your concerns in the new version.
Sit on campuses that are not safe for Jewish students. There's a safety issue. It's not just racism and what is in someone's heart. I want you to tell our group with specificity, if you would, what you have, what your organization has done to integrate those notions in the protection of Jewish students and from anti-Semitism and violence. I want you to tell us what you've done in the past year.
Okay. As an accreditor, we cannot deal with particular situations on particular campuses. So what we have done in passing 208 is allowing those processes that are on campuses to be able to be balanced and to make sure there's enforcement of non-discrimination, safe space and safety for students in the promulgation of their policies and practices pursuant to 208.
But nothing's been anti-Semitism specific.
No, we don't. That's why we're talking about why even getting into the issues of racism, bias, and cultural competence, which could and should include anti-Semitism, is not something that particularly we're getting into as an accreditor, but law schools are talking about, and they're being pressured by others on campus to say, if you have this program, it should include anti-Semitism. And so this provides the umbrella. But then it's up to the law schools to then make sure that all the students are protected and safe under their policies.
This is unrelated, but have you ever thought about requiring the faculty to take these courses?
There has certainly been not just recommendations, but it's considered a best practice for the faculty to take them as well. But yes, that's a great idea.
Have you ever tried to get a faculty to do anything? Let me just share one thing with you that is important to me personally, not representing the George Washington University Law School at all, but my personal opinion, and now you know the opinion of the person who does represent the George Washington University Law School. There's a philosopher named Franz Fanon. Anybody know who he is? 1957, African-American, and he wrote a lot about the overlap between racism and anti-Semitism. Paraphrasing what he said was, if somebody comes for the Jews, they're coming for you too. And as a result, we talk about racism as inclusive of anti-Semitism. And we talk about the hate that is reflected in both of those doctrines as one and the same.
Have you made any changes in the past year based on the recent statement?
A number. For example, if you come to my school on November the 18th, you'll hear the American Jewish Committee give us a really, really good lecture, the second time I've heard it, about a toolkit for fighting anti-Semitism on our campus.
Great, thank you.
Great questions, thank you.
Thanks. So a number of the panelists, I think Dean Matthew and Justice.
Stand up closer to the microphone so we can hear you.
There we go, better?
Yes.
So I'll start over. A number of the panelists, I think it was mainly Dean Matthew and Justice Peterson, were talking about how accreditation could serve as like a free market tell people that a school is trustworthy because the accreditor said so. Now, of course, that only works if people trust the accreditor. And over the last couple of years, we would see probably about half the country, the Olympic right half, no longer trust the ABA, which they fairly or unfairly may perceive as like a left-wing interest group. So what would be your response to them? Should we actually value ABA accreditation anymore?
So I think it's a good question kind of at a higher level of generality. I will say there are a lot of, outside of the academic context, there are accreditors. The Better Business Bureau is an example of an accreditor that the free market looks to as a mark of quality. But looking at the accreditor and looking at whether the accreditor is assessing things based on values you share is a very relevant thing. And so that really depends on what the ABA accreditation represents and what the questions are that it answers.
Thanks.
Thank you so much. John Blackman, South Ottawa. So we had an election in the Zumbi and New Department of Education. And we don't believe that will be for the ABA that is significant. When is your re-review thing going on? Is that now?
It's 2026, we go up.
So, I mean, let's just say, I don't know, Secretary of Education Chris Rufo, just being in the name. I asked predecessors this question, asked the same. Do you think the ABA might be at risk of losing their monopoly? And if so, to Justice Peterson, what other bodies might be able to fill that vacuum if the federal government says, okay, ABA had a good run, thank you.
Well, I'll be out of a job, so. No, I mean, we don't know. I mean, and the question is, I mean, I will probably be at the front of whatever challenges come because I do believe that the ABA accreditation may not be perfect, but it is the best there can be for law school lawyer accreditation. What I would say is, I mean, I think there is a question of whether it will gut the accreditation entirely or simply manage more the content of the accreditation as legislatures have. And then, of course, we will adapt.
So I think that is a question that is not susceptible to a very simple answer, in part because there are existing statutes that govern a lot of that, but also in part because my principal objection to ABA accreditation is not that the ABA is the wrong private accreditor. It's that the concept of the government relying on private accreditation altogether is problematic. I don't love the government doing it either, but some entity that has real, genuine public accountability and is accountable to the electorate, ultimately, at the end of the day, has to be responsible for the exercise of government power and determining who is eligible to receive federal benefits and to receive access to public licensing is the exercise of government power.
Thank you so much. Hi, my name's Harry Lewis. I'm an attorney in New York. And I'm looking at a Reuters article dated 2023, more states reconsider how to license lawyers, talking about apprenticeship programs that completely circumvent law school, and it says Maine joins Oregon, Georgia, and North Dakota in changes to how lawyers are admitted to practice. A bill in Maine would introduce an apprenticeship program for would-be lawyers. And the article further reports that these states are experiencing serious lawyer shortages, and also that the National Conference of Bar Examiners is developing the so-called next-gen bar exam due to be out in 2026, says the new test will emphasize practical skills. So I guess my question to the panel is, apprenticeship programs could, given these, in my view, the skyrocketing costs of law school, mm-hmm. and of all education, its costs have really risen significantly in the last decade or so, and a lot of law students now graduate with huge debt burdens. Will the economics of the academy drive further reform, including reforms in that direction?
I can jump in on this one. I think we're gonna see a lot of changes in a lot of different ways, and states across the country are looking at several different things right now. One is, as you mentioned, potential apprenticeship. There's also an access to justice issue. There is a dearth of attorneys capable of providing services to a significant portion of the population at a reasonable cost. So should we have different licensing models that provide, as in medical arenas and others, mechanisms by which individuals would be able to have limited practice scope mm-hmm. and not have to incur 3 years of legal education at the expense and pass a bar exam. There's that balance of how do you protect the public from individuals? How do we ensure that we're providing justice? How do we provide a pathway for individuals into the legal profession? All of those issues, and then the cost. All of those will be, I think, discussed at different levels. Mm-hmm. And this is the wonderful thing about the laboratory of the states, is individual states, and Justice Peterson, Justice Busby from Texas, others are going to have the ability to identify in each individual state what is appropriate for their jurisdiction, given that protection of the public and providing access to justice services.
If I can tag on to that, Justice Busby is actually participating in a panel discussing just that Saturday morning. Texas, Arizona, and Utah have all taken big steps in that direction, because we all face similar problems. Mm-hmm. In Georgia, there are 7 counties that have no lawyers whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And the problem of legal deserts is a real problem, particularly in rural areas. And you don't fix that by just magically hoping new lawyers are going to appear. And so there's a real problem that increasingly states are assessing their regulatory schemes to decide whether our regulation of the practice of law is actually creating too much of a barrier mm-hmm. to access to justice. We just began that review ourselves, sparked largely by the work at Texas. And so I want to applaud mm-hmm. The Texas Supreme Court and what they've done recently.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Yeah. And I would just add, you know, I do think that the, you know, right now the apprenticeship model and pathways to practice is being done incrementally, because again, we want to make sure that if we go forward with some of these, we don't do it 100% and then it's not an experiment doesn't go well. And also, who's going to supervise the apprentice? Who's going to pay for it? So I think these are good experiments, and we are all in favor in the ABA. We've put out a statement of the council that we applaud the pathways to practice, and of course are going to be looking at that. I think also experiments like online education, the Department of Education, for example, has got more flexible. We're getting more flexible as well, but we also want to be careful that online education is just as good as preparing lawyers as the brick and mortar, but could also help with those access issues, both for education and the community.
Could you, because the microphone, yes, get closer.
The Amy Wax case out of Pennsylvania, where a tenured chair professor lost her chair after a second adjudication. The first hearings they had on her conduct exonerated her, and a new dean came in and decided they would hold a second set of hearings notwithstanding that. It was an interesting conversation. And in light of that, and you, if you look at every study that's been done of the political demography of the Legal Academy from 1998 through 2017 with the Bonnke study, which is the most recent, in addition to one that appears on a blog page, the faculty at law schools uniformly are at least 80 to 85% Democrat, and the other 15% typically are characterized as Republican based on campaign contributions or voter affiliation. We often use race as a substitute for intellectual diversity, when in fact, if these studies are accurate, one of which was over 3,000 professors, so it seems to have an adequate database, is that sensible, or should we be looking at the ideological uniformity of legal education in this context?
I can say that we define diversity at the George Washington University Law School broadly, including ideological diversity, geographical, economic, racial, ethnic, gender, sexual identity, military service, and so many other
multiple generations, right.
And so, so many factors, because again, in order to equip someone, as we hope to do, to be a leader in a pluralist society, we have to have all those viewpoints represented. So yes, I do think, in answer to your question affirmatively, that political as well as other forms of diversity are important to represent on faculties and in the student body of the nation's leading law schools.
If a theme of this discussion is potentially that different people will be forced to believe things maybe if they don't believe because of accreditation, because of other issues, or to espouse the movement, how would necessarily having elected bodies determine the content of these discussions, how would that necessarily work against that possibility?
Well, the First Amendment applies to the government, and typically the First Amendment prohibits the government from compelling people to believe things.
Last question, because we're coming to Judge Elwood.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Elwood. I'm from Houston, Texas, and it's very nice to see my former dean, Dean Berry, on the panel today. So thank you. You know, many of us have served on boards of educational institutions, and oftentimes the administration will tell the board members, we have to do this because the ABA or the SACS SOC, whatever it's COC, it says you have to do it. Is that accurate, or am I missing something? I'm sorry to be so blunt.
Jen, close your ears. Close your ears. So I played that trick myself. At some other law school than the one I'm representing right now. The ABA is going to take away my accreditation if you don't give me more money, if you don't stop taking my surplus, if you don't give me a better building, if you don't give me more teachers. The ABA is going to take away my accreditation, and then where will we all be? And thankfully, it has worked.
Thank you for that, Jada. I didn't hear anything, but I will say, I mean, I totally understand your point. And when I have been a fellow dean, I've always given the advice: be careful and be strategic if you use the ABA card. You cannot walk into every dispute that you have and say, "I can't do this because of the ABA." I will say, though, that at least from my experience on the other side of the aisle, it has helped law schools be better, both in the quality of their programs as well as the quality of their facilities, and has created more lawyers, because the push now is for also the one-size-fits-all university. And what we are able to be able to say is that accreditation of law schools and of the profession of lawyers is something special and different and needs to be invested in a particular way. So I think that's a good thing when done strategically.
If I can add one thing to that, Judge, I have seen that happen, and it's not ABA specific. It's every educational institution that is accredited, the administration seeking to defend decisions they have made will inevitably blame others. And accreditors are very convenient blame takers. And to the legislature and to anybody else that actually has some oversight. And so, again, if the accreditor were more publicly accountable, there would perhaps be less opportunity for educational institutions to do this crossways finger pointing.
Thank you very much. Thank you, all members of the survey. Thank you very much.
You did a great job keeping us focused. I hope folks felt that it was.